It's 4:06. You're listening to Central Time on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. I'm Veronica Ricker.
And I'm Rob Ferret. Coming up, we'll talk about what might happen if no Republican presidential candidate wins a majority of delegates in time for the convention.
But first, it's time for our weekly review of state news, the Wisconsin News Roundup.
Supreme Court Justice Rebecca Bradley was in the headlines this week for some opinion pieces she wrote over 20 years ago while she attended Marquette University.
And Governor Walker signed a bill this week that allows temporary teaching licenses for vocational education teachers.
Plus, no more nude beach in Wisconsin.
Robert Menser joins us now. He's a storytelling editor for USA Today Network, Wisconsin. Rob, thanks for joining us.
Hey, thanks for having me.
So one of the major news stories this week had to do with some opinion pieces that Supreme Court Justice Rebecca Bradley, justice and candidate, that she wrote while she was at Marquette University. Catch us up on the latest there.
Yes. So the liberal activist group, One Wisconsin Now, last weekend dug out some of her old college writings for the student newspaper. Bradley, of course, was appointed to the Supreme Court in October and is running for election to the court with the election on April 5th. So some of these college writings, I mean, it's a long time ago. It's the early 1990s, but they had some pretty outlandish views, included referring to gay people as queers, saying that she had no sympathy for gay people who had contracted AIDS because they had effectively chosen to commit suicide. She wrote that most feminists were, quote, angry, militant, man-hating lesbians who abhor the traditional family. So, you know, Rebecca Bradley said that she was embarrassed by the comments. She said they don't reflect her worldview. She later told reporters for the Wisconsin State Journal that she was deeply sorry for what she had written. But there's still something, I mean, there's something shocking about seeing such over-the-top, such sort of intensely partisan-style statements from somebody who's running for the office of Supreme Court Justice.
And what has Governor Walker had to say about this?
So Governor Walker said that it was appropriate for Bradley to apologize and said that he was not aware of these writings. And he did express that it didn't cause him to reconsider his appointments, or he still has faith in her as a justice, and so on. But I mean, I think that it's raised questions, and a lot of, you know, in a sense, it's a political hit from a liberal group, but there's a lot of people that are needing to kind of back away from these statements.
Is there anything surprising about the fact that it took this long for these opinion pieces to be made public? It seems as though you're running for a Supreme Court. You're on the Supreme Court in Wisconsin. It's a state election, not a national election, but it seems as though this sort of thing could have come to light earlier.
Yeah, and she's been a judge before. She's been appointed to two other offices by Governor Walker before she was appointed to the Supreme Court. So yeah, it's sort of interesting. I mean, it's a triumph of Oppo research, I suppose, and it's very interesting. Like, it's hard not to read some of these crazy old columns. But yeah, I mean, there's no question. It comes in the context of they're in a hard fought political campaign. Joanne Kloppenburg is the Supreme Court candidate who is favored by liberals in Wisconsin. And those who want to see Bradley ousted want to make as much as they can out of these old writings.
And it's definitely been a challenging week for Bradley. News also came out yesterday about her taking a case for someone who she'd been romantically linked to. What is the update there?
Yeah, another Milwaukee Journal Sentinel report. They uncovered some old legal briefs that this man's ex-wife had alleged that it was a conflict of interest for her, Bradley, to represent this man because the two of them had been in a romantic had dated. And basically the judge in that case, that was from 2004, the judge in that case did not agree and said that there wasn't an ethical issue, and it's in a way it's no big deal. The Journal Sentinel did report that Bradley and the man started dating when Bradley was separated from her husband and living apart, but was still technically married. So the first story on this was billed as an extramarital affair, and I think that maybe that is a little bit of an overstatement, and I think that there's been a lot of pushback from Bradley and conservative allies, including her own ex-husband, against the characterization of this dating relationship as an extramarital affair.
Now, Rob, all of this sort of broke just this week, but is there any indication whether voters are going to care about this or not?
Well, you know, it's hard to get people to pay attention to any Supreme Court race except when there are sort of explosive negative allegations, right? This is a pattern that we've seen over and over in Supreme Court races, that the because the candidates don't take policy positions, they don't say, I will rule in this way in this case, they're not allowed to say that. So every one of these races becomes about issues of character and the candidate's past and so on. And so this is, to the extent that people pay attention to Supreme Court races, you kind of are left with these highly sensational stories.
We're talking right now with Robert Menser, storytelling editor for the USA Today Network in Wisconsin. We're getting our Wisconsin News Roundup right now. And in other news, Governor Walker signed a bill that would create temporary teaching licenses based on experience for vocational teachers. What's the big change here?
So this is a law that would allow people to get these three-year licenses to go in and teach things like agriculture or food service or marketing or some other subjects, what are called non-core subjects. So this does not apply to your reading, writing, and arithmetic. They could get these teaching credentials based more easily on their experience working in that field. So this is the supporters of the law. Governor Walker say that it's a response to specific shortages in these areas, and that it'll make it easier for schools to connect with people who, have worked in the field and are able to teach that to students. Of course, we know what many teachers think of Governor Walker, and there are critics who say that this is of a piece with sort of Act 10 reforms and a way of, deprofessionalizing or devaluing teaching as a profession.
Why did the governor make the case that this was something Wisconsin needed?
So, it seems that there are actual shortage of these sorts of vocational positions. It's not unique, and it's not unusual to hear some of these positions are hard to fill. So, it is in a certain way of looking at it, you might not think it would be a controversial bill at all. It's people who can demonstrate that that they have experience in the field that they'll be teaching. It certainly doesn't require the districts to hire anybody. It's not like they're going to be, districts are going to start plucking people off the streets, but it's just, it comes in a climate where teachers feel really disrespected. Even Governor Walker's statement at the signing of this bill in Brown Deer was all about Act 10 and the positive changes from his point of view that law, which gutted teachers' unions, has brought to school districts. So it fits into this partisan context, and it's seen as part of this sort of larger pattern.
And finally, Rob, in a bit of unusual news this week, the Wisconsin DNR has decided to close the state's only nude beach. What happened?
Sad, sad. They're coming for our nude beaches. Can you believe it?
All right. So why was that decision made?
Yeah. So this, of course, as you know, is the Mazo Beach, Mazomani Beach in sort of northwestern Dane County. It has long been a beloved hangout for people who like to bathe in the nude. And it's long been sort of a thorn in the side of the state DNR. They say that they are responding to repeated issues of drug use and public sex at the site, and it's true. There have been cases where people are arrested for exactly those things. They also say that they're going to make the beach now, this whole area will be good for, hiking and fishing and stuff. So good news, finally there'll be a place in Wisconsin where we can go hiking or fishing.
And I mean, it's not completely without controversy. There are people who use this beach. What has the response been from naturist supporters?
They're so sad. They're going to have to go all the way to Valparaiso, Indiana to get naked on a beach. It's unfair. Now listen, I mean, it's sort of funny, but on the other hand, what there are not cases of are things like assault or any sort of a crime that has a victim, you might say. So they say that this has been part of Mezo Beach for decades, and this is important to the community of naturists, and they're not hurting anyone. So they sort of feel like they're being targeted, and they kind of are.
Yeah, we leave it there. Rob, thanks a lot.
All right, thank you.
That was news editor Robert Menser joining us to recap the biggest headlines from around the state this week for our Wisconsin News Roundup.
Coming up, a group of Republicans wants Paul Ryan to be their presidential nominee. We'll look at what a contested convention might lead to. First, look at some of the latest news with J. Carlisle Larson.
You're listening to Central Time. I'm Veronica Rickert.
And I'm Rob Ferret. Coming up, our guest doctor says there's a lot of gray area in the world of medicine, and patients and doctors will get better results when they acknowledge the uncertainty.
First, a political action committee is trying to get Paul Ryan to consider becoming the Republican nominee for president. But Ryan wants nothing to do with it so far. In fact, he sent a cease and desist order to the Draft Paul Ryan Group to get them to stop raising money in his name.
But the idea of a candidate with zero delegates ending up with the nomination could maybe happen in a contested convention, with many Republicans upset with the frontrunner Donald Trump. We're asking our next guest what a contested convention could produce. Joining us now is Susan Johnson. She's Dean and Associate Professor of Political Science at the UW-Whitewater. Susan, welcome back to the show.
Thanks, Rob. Glad to be here.
Well, Donald Trump could win a clear majority. Maybe Ted Cruz could, too. But if nobody does come into that convention with a majority of delegates, the result would be, I guess, this contested convention. What would that look like?
Well, the way it works right now, and this is a change from most recent prior conventions, is that the delegates are bound to vote for the candidate that they originally committed to on the first ballot. So there would need to be a vote, and they would have to show that, in fact, no candidate, in this case, if you want to use Trump as the example, if no candidate received a majority, at that point, then we would get into a process where delegates would be unbound, and then they would be open to vote for a candidate of their choice.
And that candidate, depending on the rules, which they could change just before or even at the convention, I understand, depending on the rules, that candidate could be somebody who already has delegates. It could be somebody else like Paul Ryan or Mitt Romney have been names that have been thrown around.
Absolutely. So the way the rules are written now, there's this obscure item that was put into the rules during 2012 that required a candidate to have won, I believe it was 8 primaries. And I've heard people on the internet talking about what that means for the likelihood of someone like Paul Ryan or Mitt Romney or anyone else. And that's really kind of a placeholder policy, if you want to consider it that way. And at the convention, the first thing that the party does is they get together and they kind of revisit the rules and set what the rules will be for that particular convention. So they could very easily make it so that someone who, yes, won no states or received no delegates could, in fact, be the nominee.
This hinges on nobody coming in with a majority. And Mitt Romney, we mentioned, he is said, hey, we should coordinate our efforts and make sure Donald Trump doesn't get that majority, and says people vote for the non-Trump frontrunner in whatever state you're in. That seems like a pretty tricky strategy to put together, doesn't it?
Absolutely. And so what we're hearing is that Republicans who don't want Trump to be the nominee should be voting for Rubio if you're in Florida, or John Kasich if you're in Ohio, and all in hopes of keeping Trump from getting the majority of delegates that would then give him the nomination at the convention.
And we've heard from, in the news today, a Rubio staff person not exactly coming out and saying, hey, if you're in Ohio and you like Rubio, vote for Kasich, but really strongly implying that as part of the strategy. For Rubio at this point, he's pretty clearly not on track to get a majority. That might be his only hope of keeping the race alive, so he might have a chance in a convention.
Right, I heard that, and then I also heard that Rubio was kind of pressed on that very same thing, and it led to an awkward exchange with the person who was asking him those questions. Mm-hmm. But yeah, that would be his only chance, and I think there's a lot of people in what we would consider the so-called establishment of the Republican Party who are still holding out hope that Rubio could potentially be the nominee, but if he doesn't do well in Florida, I don't see any path, even if we got to the convention and no one had a majority.
And we talk about the party establishment a lot these days, but things are different now than they used to be. There aren't really those bosses, those key players with the pull and the clout to wheedle delegates one way or another. Is the party establishment a more amorphous concept than we might imagine?
Yeah, and I think that, you know, people have been using the term brokered convention, and now we're using the term contested convention. And because even the term brokered convention suggests that image of the political movers and shakers, perhaps in a smoke-filled room, making decisions behind closed doors. If we got to the point where the convention was contested, it would be, I would think, a more open process. But let's not kid ourselves. There would still be people who would try to be playing that role of kingmaker to whatever extent. I would think Reince Priebus, for example, as head of the RNC. I would think that Speaker Ryan, as Speaker of the House, obviously Mitch McConnell. So those people, key governors, would certainly be trying to have a say in who the eventual nominee is.
Well, Donald Trump has touted himself as the master of the art of the deal. So if he came in with not quite that majority, but pretty close, one possible outcome would be he'd get the rest of the delegates, maybe not in the first round, but the second or third round, he'd end up winning anyway.
Yeah, that's actually interesting that you bring that up, because everyone's assuming that if he doesn't get the majority on the first go, that that is the end of his likelihood of getting the nomination. And I tend to agree with that, but there is always that chance that should he not get what he needed, but he was close enough, he might be able on the second ballot to be able to convince enough people to go his way.
Talking to Susan Johnson from UW-Whitewater about the possibility of a contested convention for the Republican Party if nobody gets a clear majority in time for that convention. So on the political side of things, for the Republican Party, there's a calculus, I think, for people we might consider in the establishment of which is worse, having Donald Trump, the candidate that we don't want, carrying the banner for the Republican Party, or having this angry senator convention coming up with somebody else and really disaffecting a lot of probably core Republican voters who have said, yeah, we do want Donald Trump. How do they weigh that?
Well, I think that what's been going on probably since people started to realize that this Donald Trump thing isn't going to go away. And so, you know, right around Iowa, I would say that Republican Party leadership started to draft options and plans for what might happen going forward. And the two things that you mentioned, either coalescing around Trump and accepting the fact that he's going to be the nominee and then going with that, or doing whatever they could to undermine Trump, which strategy would be the best strategy? And they had been taking this wait-and-see attitude, and then it seemed like they tried to go with the let's try to undermine him as best we can in hopes that we can knock him off of that front-runner status. And that didn't seem to work. That was almost a little bit too little too late. And now we're hearing more and more people who are coming out and saying, well, we will support the nominee regardless of who it is. And so there's almost these different stages, and they're in this stage almost of acceptance, but they're really holding out strong hope that he won't get that majority and they won't have to go all the way with him.
People on the Democratic side, I want to turn there for a bit, have talked about, well, what happens if it's really close between Sanders and Clinton, and they have the whole superdelegate thing, a bigger deal on the Democratic side. There's sort of an equivalent on the Republican side. I don't think they call them superdelegates. But could we end up with some sort of convention contest between those two?
Well, you're right. There's a lot more superdelegates on the Democratic side, and we've heard a lot more conversations on that side about them as a result. I would say that what we have to remember is that back in 2008, there were also a number of superdelegates who were committed to Hillary Clinton, who when they saw Barack Obama taking a lead, they switched. And so it's not out of the realm of possibility that you could get superdelegates seeing how their state supported a particular candidate and then making the decision to switch and go with the will of the voters. I don't know that we get there, but certainly superdelegates are not bound to who they've already promised to, so they could change.
But if there is what appears to be a clear winner, the superdelegates tend to go that way?
Right, and they don't matter as much either. So I don't think any superdelegates really want to be seen as the ones who alter the course of an election.
Now, a lot of times parties seem to change their convention rules based on what happened last time. They've switched around primary schedules. That 8-state rule you mentioned, the Republican Party, I think was sort of the let's not let Ron Paul supporters protest at the convention rule, pretty much. Do those come with unforeseen consequences, unintended consequences, when they tweak the rules to meet that current scenario?
Right, absolutely. So what the parties tend to do is they reflect on what the most recent nominating situation looked like, and then they adjust the rules based on that history. And there's not a lot of foresight there. I mean, superdelegates were created as a result of looking back at 76 and the Dems not liking the fact that Jimmy Carter won the nomination. And so there's always this tweaking that goes on, but it's the tweaking of hindsight and not foresight, and it's come back in more than one case to be problematic for either party.
I won't ask you to predict how this will come out, Susan, because I don't think anybody can do that. But what are you watching for in the next couple of weeks to see if Donald Trump might be able to just get that clear majority?
I'm watching to see what happens Tuesday, because we've got some big states, and a couple of them are winner-take-all. And I really believe that if he wins Florida and does well and wins Illinois, let's say, and see what happens in Ohio, I think it's going to be pretty hard.
Susan, thanks a lot, as always, for joining us.
Absolutely. Happy to do it.
That's Susan Johnson. She's a dean and an associate professor of political science at UW-Whitewater, talking about the possibility of a contested Republican national convention.
Coming up, our guest doctor tells us why uncertainty is such a big part of medicine. I'm Veronica Rickert.
And I'm Rob Ferret. You're listening to Central Time here on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. You're listening to Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret.
And I'm Veronica Rickert. Coming up, Governor Walker signed Act 10 into law 5 years ago today. We'll talk about the changes in Wisconsin politics since then and what lies ahead.
First, a lot of us have had an experience with healthcare where we have some kind of problem. We go to the clinic hoping for a solid answer, a diagnosis and a plan of action. And we leave with no answer, no diagnosis, no prescription. So what went wrong? Did the doctor miss something? Did we not describe our symptoms well enough?
But maybe nothing went wrong at all. Our next guest says uncertainty plays a big role in medicine, and most patients and providers don't know just how big those gray areas are. And that can lead to problems of overdiagnosis and overtreatment, or maybe steer people into potentially harmful behaviors because they think that all medical care is equally unreliable.
Dr. Stephen Hatch joins us now. He's a physician and an assistant professor of medicine at the University of Massachusetts Medical School. His new book is called Snowball in a Blizzard, a Physician's Notes on Uncertainty in Medicine. Dr. Hatch, thanks for joining us today.
Thanks for having me, Rob and Veronica.
So we've had so many medical advances in the last, I don't know, century or so. The medicines, high-tech imaging tools, large-scale studies. So why is there still so much uncertainty?
So what's happened is that over this past century, we've increased by quantum levels the amounts of precision that we have in making a diagnosis. And in many, many, many cases, that's allowed us to improve the accuracy and the certainty that we're actually diagnosing diseases for which we can offer treatments that are going to help. But one of the downsides that has been unrecognized or less recognized until about the past 10 or 15 years is that it doesn't increased precision is not the same thing as increased certainty. And so when we have a radiology test that can provide us exactly a pinpoint mechanism showing us that there's an abnormality, it doesn't necessarily mean that that abnormality is going to lead to any harm. And yet we often react to it as if it would.
And that leads to part of the problem with not thinking about this uncertainty, I guess, the idea that that cancer you just mentioned, that tumor we might have never detected in the past, and it might never have been a problem in the past. So now all of a sudden we're seeing this thing and maybe doing treatments which with problems of their own that might be unnecessary in the long run.
That's exactly right. And this has become a bigger and bigger problem as the resolution of our technology has improved so much more.
And there's also an idea out there, I think, that, well, if, you know, if I'm in as a patient and there's something going on, I'm going to feel like doing something is good. Doing nothing doesn't make any sense, when often in medicine, it seems like we're learning more and more the nothing option may be the better option.
That's right. And it was the source of the guidelines that had changed for instance, screening mammograms in women under the age of 50, which was a recommendation that started to change in 2009. There was really a very large controversy about that. And the idea behind those recommendations was exactly based on this kind of reasoning that you illustrate, which is sometimes doing more actually leads to harm rather than benefit.
And speaking of those mammography, that's, I think, the origin of the title of your book, Snowball in a Blizzard. Can you talk about where that comes from?
Yeah, that's an old joke that radiologists have about the difficulties of interpreting mammograms. So the idea that even I held until I really started reading about the literature was that, you know, a woman went in for a screening mammogram and that if there was a cancerous tumor, it would just be there like it was sort of waving a red flag out in the distance, and a radiologist could very easily find it. But it turns out that being able to distinguish cancerous tissue from normal tissue is actually very difficult. And so the joke that radiologists have is that trying to find a tumor in a mammogram is akin to trying to find a snowball in a blizzard.
Talking to Dr. Stephen Hatch, author of the new book, Snowball in a Blizzard, A Physician's Notes on Uncertainty in Medicine. So, Dr. Hatch, how would you like to see doctors and patients, for that matter, think about uncertainty, recognize this uncertainty to end up with better outcomes?
I think the first thing that needs to happen is that they need to sort of incorporate the concept and incorporate the vocabulary of uncertainty. So uncertainty isn't just a binary, you're uncertain or you're not. There are gradations of uncertainty. There are some things that we actually are really very, very confident about in medicine and come as close to true certainty as possible. And then there are other treatments and diagnoses where we can be reasonably confident, but we're not 100% confident. Then there are some where we're much more speculative. And then there are some things where we really have no idea at all. And for those things, we should be very careful about proceeding forward. And then how you move from there is into a discussion about risks of taking action versus the risks of doing nothing, and the benefits of taking action versus the benefits of doing nothing.
I've heard this in the context of especially people, older people, maybe people that might have a 3, 4, 5 years in their life expectancy left, then is there more harm in treating that tumor, say, that might never develop into anything worth the potential risk to that patient right now?
That's exactly right. And particularly in the field of cancer treatment, and I should point out I'm not a cancer specialist in this, I'm an infectious disease doctor. But when I've talked to oncologists about their work, one of the things that they try very carefully to do is to have a discussion with patients and their families about what the goals of treatment are. Because some people are going to want treatment no matter what at all costs, whereas other patients are going to want to understand what the potential downsides are and how much additional living that they can expect to do. And then other patients are going to be much more concerned about the quality of living that they're going to have, so they would want to avoid chemotherapy treatments that may be very toxic to them.
You mentioned a few moments ago that there are cases where we do have full-on certainty or close to, and you write, I like this, we could all benefit from this following advice, quoting here, exercise more, eat less, do not smoke. So these are things that are about as certain as we're going to get when it comes to health and medicine.
Yeah, and one of the things that I find continuously amazing whenever I watch healthcare news coverage is people talk about all sorts of miracle cures, and there's this diet and there's that diet. There's always a new diet that's around. And yet, really, if you want to boil things down into simple fundamentals, if we just ate less of whatever it is that we're eating, and if we just get out and exercise more and spend less time in the car or less time sitting around watching television, and then for the small subset of people, although it's not so small, of people who smoking really wreaks disproportionate havoc on a body. And for the most part, if you follow those three tenets, you're going to do pretty well in life.
Well, another worry that you have, I think, about uncertainty is the idea that if we find that medicine in some way is wrong or doesn't have all the answers in one sphere, we might end up rejecting medicine, healthcare as a whole, the idea being that nobody knows anything.
Yeah, I think this happens when people are promised more by a physician than the physician perhaps should. And then when the medical system or that physician fails to deliver, people feel so let down that they don't trust anything that the system has to offer. And I've encountered many patients who have stories to tell like that, where they don't trust any doctor once they've sort of experienced the sour taste of having thought that they knew what a diagnosis was and then go to the next doctor and says, you know, well, that's not it at all.
Well, one area where this is really very relevant to you in the Northeast, very relevant to us here in Wisconsin, Lyme disease. And you talk about the alternative practices that have grown up surrounding Lyme disease, in part because of this confusion over what is meant by uncertainty. Can you talk a little bit about that?
Yeah, so that occupies an entire chapter in the book, because Lyme disease is a very complicated topic. Part of it results from the fact that the testing that we have for Lyme disease is not always good, and it varies from situation to situation. So, for instance, if somebody comes in acutely ill and it looks like they may have Lyme disease, for instance, it's the late summer and they're in Wisconsin and they've just come back from a backpacking trip where they've been exposed to ticks, and then they have a fever and a rash, that is very likely to be Lyme disease, and a negative test wouldn't necessarily rule that diagnosis out. But as time goes on and people develop symptoms of chronic fatigue, and it can last for months and months, if somebody has a negative Lyme test, that test gets increasingly more reliable. And one of the things that I talk about in the book is how there's been a group of people who have experienced chronic fatigue, and they have joined forces with doctors who believe that the cause of the chronic fatigue is an ongoing Lyme infection from which chronic antibiotics, potentially years in duration, are the right way to treat it. And mainstream physicians avoid this approach. And the reason why they avoid the approach is because we've done studies to find out whether or not those people would benefit from prolonged antibiotics. And it turns out that when we try to look at any benefits that can be had, none can be found.
We're talking to Dr. Stephen Hatch about his new book. It's called Snowball in a Blizzard, A Physician's Notes on Uncertainty in Medicine. He says uncertainty is a big part of healthcare, more than most patients and practitioners realize.
You can join the conversation at 800-642-1234 with your questions and your experiences. Have you encountered this kind of uncertainty as a patient? Were you frustrated, or did you and the doctor work together to come up with a plan? If you work in the healthcare field, how does this play out for you? Call 800-642-1234 or post on the Central Time Facebook page.
We'll continue the conversation after looking at the latest news with J. Carlisle Larson. This is Central Time. I'm Rob Farah.
And I'm Veronica Rickert. We continue our conversation with Dr. Stephen Hatch. His new book is called Snowball in a Blizzard, A Physician's Notes on Uncertainty in Medicine. He says there's more gray area in medicine than we might think, and we'll be better off as patients and as doctors if we pay attention to that uncertainty.
You can join the conversation at 800-642-1234. Have you seen this kind of uncertainty in healthcare as a patient, as a family member, or as a healthcare provider yourself? Does it ever make you skeptical of healthcare in general? And what do you think of the way that the media covers medical issues? The reports on this is good for you, this isn't, and next week, maybe it's the other way around. Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234, or post on the Central Time Facebook page. And Dr. Hatch, I wanted to ask you about that media coverage issue. There's a lot of health reporting, a lot of reporting on research. You're not that happy with the way a lot of that is done.
Yeah, I think that one of the big problems about media reporting about health is that they over-sensationalize what medicine is actually capable of achieving. So they tend to play up studies that are highly speculative or really very early in the pipeline because it draws a lot of viewers. And then the other part that I think that they don't do very well is they don't give balance and context for how certain we can be. And just as you said in the introduction to this this part of the show, you noted that, you know, one day you've got a set of guidelines that say the sun is coming up in the east, and then the next day the guidelines say, no, sorry, the sun is coming up in the west. And without the sense of, well, the benefits that they found, the guidelines say that the benefits are small but real, then if they do further studies and show that the benefits actually weren't found to be there, that's very different than saying, do this, and then 3 years later saying, no, sorry, don't do that.
And you focus in on the health benefits, real or imagined, of chocolate. Can you talk about how that's played out over the years?
Yeah, so chocolate, so first of all, I want to say I'm a big fan of chocolate. But whether or not chocolate has health benefits is something for which the media loves to report, and they love to talk about these observational studies, most of which are not especially well designed. And they have this tendency to not really explain the fine print, which shows that if you look at people consuming chocolate, that a very, very small number of them are shown to have, for instance, lower levels of heart failure in the people who eat dark chocolate. But they don't really go to the trouble of explaining how the studies were done and the size of the benefit. And you don't really need a PhD in statistics to be able to understand this stuff.
Well, and I wonder if this feeds kind of a health anxiety, if we are the sort of people who focus on these health stories and are trying to figure out what's going to be the healthiest way to live, and picking through all those studies, does this, in a way, make us more stressed out and ultimately less healthy?
Yeah, I absolutely think so, which is why, as you noted earlier, like the way to live healthy is to eat modestly, it's to exercise, and to sort of enjoy life and not smoke cigarettes. And the way, if you read health news every day, and obviously it depends on the outlet, but I would get stressed out if I read that stuff every single day, and I wouldn't know what the right diet to have was, and I wouldn't know whether I should do the Mediterranean diet or the Sears diet or the Zone diet. And I think that all that does is it just creates a huge amount of anxiety, of this feeling like if you don't do it perfectly, you're going to get something wrong and you're going to have a downstream bad effect.
Let's go to our callers now. We've got Mylia on the line in Madison. Hi.
Hi. So I was just calling because, you know, I guess it's not more about health that I was calling about, more about pain, you know. I had an incident where basically I was seeing an MD. It was my third child that I just had, and I was nursing her, and it was a constant battle on this infection that I was having, and I'm a fairly young person, and I guess I wanted to talk about, like, how do you manage pain, and although you may be healthy, but you may have chronic pain.
Mylia, what did your doctor recommend to you? What were you on for this?
I was on antibiotics, and for a long time. I was actually with a really renowned doctor that put me on lots of different types of antibiotics because I was battling this really bad infection.
Gotcha, Mylia. Thanks a lot. I just wanted to get a little more detail there. So a couple issues there, Dr. Hatch. One thing, the desire to do something for an infection or maybe a more vague condition often leads to antibiotic prescription, overprescription, a lot of people are worried about these days.
Yeah, antibiotic overprescription is definitely a problem because it feeds that sense that if you come to the doctor and you think you have an infection, then you need to treat the infection and use the antibiotics. And sometimes, for instance, people come in with viral infections for which antibiotics aren't helpful. And then when we give people antibiotics, all we're doing is increasing the likelihood of bacterial resistance. As far as Mylia's point about pain, the treatment of chronic pain, I think one of the important things that's important for doctors to be aware of is to really always validate the patient's sense of pain, even when we can't find a cause. So chronic pain is a little bit like chronic fatigue. We can only do so many studies before we're out of ideas of the things that we can fix, but just because we're out of studies doesn't make that pain any less real.
And this is a big question of what to prescribe and when, and concerns over addiction to forms of pain medication.
Yeah, I mean, the treatment of chronic pain is of course fraught with all kinds of problems, because what treatments that we have for pain generally have addictive potential. And so I think that that's a very tough situation in medicine right now. And what my feeling is that what we can do on the medicine side of things is to make sure that we aren't dismissive of our patients and their pain and say, well, you know, I did this x-ray and the x-ray didn't show anything, therefore you must be making it up. And I think doctors, not all doctors obviously, but sometimes doctors can send that message, sometimes overtly and then sometimes without even realizing it. And then patients feel very violated when that happens.
Mylia, thanks for that call. We're talking to Dr. Stephen Hatch. His new book is called Snowball in a Blizzard, A Physician's Notes on Uncertainty in Medicine. I wonder how much the answer is kind of a culture change here, because I'll say as a patient, I would love to walk in and have the authority figure definitively tell me what's wrong. And I think there's at least a stereotype of doctors in particular wanting to be that authority figure and tell people definitively what's wrong. Do we both need to step back and change the way we think about that?
My sense of medicine is that there should be an authority figure, but the authority figure is the patient and not the doctor. I think what a doctor should be is an advisor. I have a fair amount of technical knowledge, and I also have the experience of seeing patients on a daily basis, which allows me to provide context to lab reports and physical examinations and hearing a patient's history. That's what I bring to the table, but what the patient brings is their knowledge of themselves. And so what I try to do whenever I meet with patients, whether it's an inpatient setting when they're usually pretty sick or an outpatient setting where the problem's less urgent, is to try to find that area in which we can both bring our relative areas of expertise so that we can try to come up with a plan that really is directed by the patient. So I don't want to be the person to come in and say, do this, don't do that. But I want to be able to come in and say, the labs show this. My level of confidence that the diagnosis is this is pretty good. I think that a reasonable solution would be this, but there are upsides and there are downsides to that.
Let's bring on another caller. We've got Scott on the line in Appleton. Scott, hi.
Hey, how are you guys doing? One thing that for the past couple of years my family's had to deal with is doctors in trying to, doctors and concussions. And it basically comes down to, from what I found, if you don't end up with some minimal brain damage that can be seen on a scan, many of the doctors just try and blow it off and, well, you know, this, that, especially if it didn't occur while on the sports field.
Interesting, Scott. Thanks for the call. Dr. Hatch, concussions, going into the brain, evaluating that sort of thing, that seems like the grayest of all gray areas in some ways.
Yeah, so I think what Scott's touching on is the problems about interpreting a negative test. So when you have a test that finds nothing, does that mean that nothing is there, or does that mean that just we didn't find what we were looking for? It's a little bit like, you know, kind of looking for your keys under the lamppost in the parking lot, and you look there because that's where the light is. It doesn't mean that the keys aren't somewhere else.
Scott, thanks a lot for the call. Briefly, as you wrap up, Dr. Hatch, do you think people are taking this issue of uncertainty more seriously in the medical profession?
I think it's starting to become a recognized phenomenon as more large-scale studies have been done, particularly about the issues of overdiagnosis and overtreatment. There's been an increasing recognition that all the technology we have is not always beneficial. And there's been a reconsideration. We're only really at the beginning of that. And I think that patients need to be more aware of this issue in medicine so that they can begin having conversations with their doctors about whether or not they're really going to benefit from some new technology or even some existing technology.
We'll leave it there for now. Dr. Hatch, thanks a lot for joining us.
Thank you very much for having me.
That's Dr. Stephen Hatch, Assistant Professor of Medicine at the University of Massachusetts Medical School. He's the author of the new book, Snowball in a Blizzard, A Physician's Notes on Uncertainty in Medicine.
coming up next, it's news from NPR and WPR, and then we'll look at the changing political landscape in Wisconsin 5 years after Act 10 was signed into law. I'm Veronica Rickert.
And I'm Rob Ferrat. This is Central Time here on the Ideas Network.